From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
The question of what to do about the settlements is perhaps the most pressing thing facing Israeli politicians today. With me now is Gershom Gorenberg, author of a new book called The Accidental Empire, which is published by Henry Holt. Mr. Gorenberg has written for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, Jerusalem Report, among others, and I'm very pleased that his book has brought him to my show today. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
What defines an Israeli settlement?
Well, when we talk about the settlements, usually what we mean is Israeli communities that have been established beyond the 1967 borders of Israel. The term is occasionally used just to mean any place that Jews settled on the land and started farming it, for instance, kibbutzim, way back before the beginning of the state. But in today's context, we're talking about communities beyond the 67 lines.
And when was the first one of them founded?
The first one was actually founded just 5 weeks after the Six-Day War of June 1967, a fact that very few people are aware of. It was started in the Golan Heights. It was started by members of a far-left kibbutz movement who combined a radical socialist vision with a nationalist belief in the whole land of Israel, which they thought had been divided up by imperialist powers. And they sought to settle in the Golan Heights, both to prevent Syrian guns from returning to the heights and bombarding Israel, and also because they believed that that was part of the Jewish homeland.
I'm surprised because I always thought that the settlement movement was pretty much a right-wing movement. Have things changed over the years, or has it not been presented in full in the American press?
Well, frankly, I was surprised, too, when I started doing the research. That wasn't my outline, and what I came up with at the end were quite different, because the picture of settlements, not only in the American press, but in Israeli national consciousness, is of something started by the right, and particularly by the religious right. What I found is that the settlement, the process of settling in the territories was initiated during the years of labor rule between 1967 and 1977. It involved people who were politically on the left. Initially, the religious settlers were their understudies, their junior partners. The people who began the settlement movement or who first initiated starting settlements were people who had come of age before the establishment of the State of Israel in what we could call the revolutionary period. And they saw the 1967 war, the acquisition of new territory, as in some ways taking them back to those glorious years of their youth. In some ways, they reacted to the 67 war the way a 60s person might have felt if they woke up today and discovered that Eugene McCarthy was president and that Woodstock was tomorrow, only for much longer. It seemed that all the good days were back again, and settling the land was part of that.
I always thought that it took a while for the settlement movement to get started because the captured lands originally were viewed as bargaining chips in a future peace agreement.
Well, the problem was that the policy was contradictory. There was a tremendous amount of indecision. For a number of reasons, the 67 war, the victory, actually produced political paralysis in Israel. Immediately after the war, a week after the war, the Israeli cabinet agreed to offer to return to the international border with Syria and Egypt, that is to say, to give back the Golan and the Sinai Peninsula in return for a full formal peace. And that offer was passed on to the United States government and turned down by Syria and Egypt. At the same time...
Let's stop there for a second. So is it possible that if Syria and Egypt had had a different response, we wouldn't be talking about any of this now?
Well, we certainly wouldn't be talking about settlements in the Golan Heights.
But it probably would have set a precedent that would have pressured Jordan and other countries to go along with.
Yes, absolutely. A major part of the reason that the settlement enterprise began is because of the diplomatic stalemate, which was produced by the fact that the Arab countries were unwilling to enter into formal public negotiations. The Israeli bottom line after the war is, we're not making any partial deals. We're not pulling back in return for peacekeeping forces. Peacekeeping forces just pulled out and let the war happen in May of 1967. We're not going for partial deals. If you go for the full thing, which is formal full peace, we'll pull back to the boundary. And that offer did not get a response from the Arab side. And then Israeli leaders started saying, well, it seems like we're going to be here for a while. And then that old impulse to start settling began to come out.
Mm-hmm. So all the Israeli leaders at the time, Moshe Dayan, Golda Meir, Eshkol, Rabin, they were all in agreement?
There were many disagreements, but I would say there were two basic lines of agreement on the Israeli side. One was that within Israel, there was a sense of agreement by the end of the summer of 1967 that the Arabs were not willing to make peace. That particularly followed what's known as the Khartoum Summit, where leaders of eight Arab nations got together in the capital of Sudan and issued the famous statement that there would be no peace, no recognition, and no negotiations with Israel. So there was agreement that negotiations weren't going anywhere. And there was agreement on the basic idea that it was okay to settle someplace in the occupied territories. Where, under what circumstances, how, was a matter of tremendous debate. And there was no single strategic decision. It's not like one policy was agreed on. They set up one settlement. They set up another settlement. The business grew.
And the debate, I assume, wasn't just within the levels of government, that this was something that was being argued in the press and everywhere else.
Yes, to some extent, although a lot of the decisions that were made about settlement in the early years were made quite quietly. The labor approach to doing things could be called speak not at all and carry a very large hoe. You settled the land quietly. You didn't make grand diplomatic statements. So the public was not fully aware of what was going on, and that's one reason that the picture today that most people have of how the settlements developed is wrong, because back then the public didn't really know what was going on.
And is that why you call this the accidental empire?
Well, there were two reasons I called it the accidental empire. One is that it resulted from the June 1967 Six-Day War, which was a complete accident. It wasn't expected by either side. It was a result of a crisis badly handled. Israeli intelligence had said just 2 months before the war that war with the Arab states was not likely within the next several years. So the war itself was an accident, and the policy of settlement grew more out of indecision than out of decision. So in that sense, it wasn't intentional in the sense of a single strategic decision.
My guest is Gershon Gorenberg, author of any number of books, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, co-author of Shalom Friend, The Life and Legacy of Yitzhak Rabin, and now The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, published by Times Books. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. A lot of this is based on new research. Has this information been available, or has it just been recently made available?
A lot of the papers I looked at are documents that are newly available that used to be top secret. On many of the documents, there was a 30-year secrecy requirement, so they're just opening up now. There were other archives that were available, but I was looking at papers that either people hadn't seen before, or without the secret ones, they didn't make as much sense. And that was also true on the American side. One of the subjects I looked at was the whole American relationship to the settlement enterprise. And here, too, there were papers available that had been secret in the past.
Has this book been published in Israel?
No, not yet.
So you don't know what kind of response you're going to get. But I suspect some people will be very surprised.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's already been press coverage of the book in Israel, and people have been surprised about the extent of the labor involvement. If I can just give you one example, Israeli maps don't show the pre-67 border of Israel, what's called the Green Line. And everybody in Israel knows that the line isn't there. The Green Line in Israeli society is sort of like sex in Victorian society. We all know it's there, but we don't talk about it. We don't show it. But nobody knew when it was erased. And I found the document in the correspondence file of the man who was then labor minister and a very important figure in the government, Yigal Alon, from October of 1967, in which he instructed the head of the government map department, from here on in, that line will not appear on the maps.
So that was very early in this whole story.
Absolutely. It was just a few months after the Six-Day War. The Israeli government had decided that they wouldn't return to the Green Line in the West Bank. They hadn't decided where they would return to, but they erased the line.
Were they sending a signal to the Arab leaders who had refused to negotiate?
They were making it clear that the pre-war lines were not going to be the lines in the future. There was tremendous disagreement within the Israeli government itself of what to aim for, which caused paralysis. But one thing they knew is that they didn't want to go back to the old line.
How did Arab leaders respond to this change? Not just, they must have been aware that the line was being erased, but also that settlements were being established.
You know, at the beginning, the Arab leaders, for that matter, the American leaders, took a while to understand that this was a serious issue. In September of 1967, the first time that the government publicly approved a settlement in the West Bank, there was an editorial in a Jordanian paper saying they're not really intending to settle there. This is just a pressure tactic to try to force us into direct negotiations. So you see there what they were really afraid of. They didn't realize that the settlements were going to cause them a problem, but the idea that they'd have to sit down at the same negotiating table with the Israelis in public was terrifying.
I assume that the Israelis have thrown that up to Arab negotiators in later negotiations.
Well, it's not so much that they've put that up to
Arab... and now you're really upset that we have these settlements, but you had so many opportunities.
Look, that's been a theme throughout the uncertain and broken and incomplete negotiating process for years, is the question of for whom is time working in their favor and for whom is time working against them. For many years, each side had the misimpression that time was working in their favor. One of the things that made the Arab side realize that time was working against them was the growth of the settlements.
Were the settlements legal in terms of international law or in terms of the Geneva Convention?
In September of 1967, before Levi Eshkol approved the first settlement, he turned to the legal advisor, to the legal counsel of the foreign ministry, who was Israel's top expert on international law, and he asked him exactly that question. The man's name was Theodore Meron. He was later a professor of international law at NYU and is now on the International Court for the Former Yugoslavia. Meron was then a young lawyer in the Foreign Service, and Meron wrote a memo back to Eshkol saying, settling civilians in the occupied territories contravenes the Fourth Geneva Convention. But he also said, as an aside, the only way that anybody could settle in the territories was temporarily in a military framework. Eshkol exploited that loophole, whatever Meron's intent was, whether he intended to present a loophole or he was just making an aside, and the first settlement was labeled as being part of the army.
Well, when did it become apparent that these settlements were in for the long haul?
I found in the American archives, I looked both in the Lyndon Johnson Library in Austin and in the National Archives in Washington, outside of Washington, there was a cable. There were cables from the American embassy in Tel Aviv to the State Department in the spring of 1968 saying, gee, it looks like these aren't just military bases, that they're really settlements. And then there was a cable back from the State Department saying, please remind the Israelis that we see settlement in the territories as an obstacle to peace and as a violation of the Geneva Convention.
Now, even what we call these areas has been open to debate. Occupied territory is not the way they're described in Israel, is it?
No. This was part of the political indecision, actually, after the 67 war. All sorts of names were used at the time, ranging, in popular speech, ranging, depending on your political position, from occupied territory to liberated territory to redeemed territory. And eventually the government decided on what they found is the most neutral term they could, which was administered territory.
But in this country, we tend to say the West Bank, and then some people have used old names, biblically derived names, haven't they?
By the end of 1967, the Israeli government documents had switched from calling it the West Bank to calling it Judea and Samaria as biblical Jewish terms instead of the West Bank. Of course, this comes back to what I said before about sex in Victorian society. Everybody knows that Judea and Samaria means the West Bank, means occupied territory. It's a euphemism, but if you say you live in Judea and Samaria, it means you live in a settlement.
But when we get a news report here, we're sure to hear occupied territories from Palestinians, and we're sure to hear something else from Israelis.
Yes, that's true.
And what we hear from Israelis often is a reflection of where they stand on the political spectrum.
Oh, absolutely. There is no such thing as neutral nomenclature in any of this. What you call a place means taking a stand. One of the things that's most difficult about writing this subject is particularly trying to approach it from a point of view of an objective historian, is that the language itself is you know, wearing an armband of the right or the left.
So what have you chosen to call them?
I used the term occupied territory. I used that term because I go all the way back to that Meron document and to later Israeli legal positions, which indicate that the territory is, in objective terms, being administered as something under military occupation. And I think that it was important to avoid euphemisms. The euphemisms are useful for a political debate. I was trying to describe what the situation actually is.
My guest is Gershom Gorenberg. His book, The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, is published by Times Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Gershom Gorenberg. His book, his latest book, The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, published by Times Books. So when did the whole thing become a settler movement? When did it start snowballing?
Well, the settlement movement as we understand it today, as the religious settlement movement, the movement connected to the religious right, developed slowly in the late 60s and early 70s. One of the things that happened was that even though the leaders of the Labor Party were interested in it, their sons and daughters weren't. And you start new settlements with 20-year-olds, not with 50-year-olds. So
this is at a time when kibbutzim are becoming less and less popular.
Well, their golden age was past, let's put it that way. They were establishment. They were institutions, not revolutions. And the second generation didn't have the enthusiasm. They were on kibbutz because that's where they lived. You know, it was home. It wasn't a cause. And they weren't going out to settle new land. And they weren't as excited about this idea of settling in occupied territory. And there wasn't manpower. And in the meantime, the young religious Zionists saw an opportunity for the first time to be the vanguard rather than the also-rans. And they also had a theology which was boosted by the June 1967 Six-Day War, which said that the establishment of the State of Israel and the Six-Day War proved that God was bringing the events of the end of history, the Messiah, and that settling the land was the way to accelerate that process. So they stepped into the breach, and whereas by 1973, 1974, the government had an unofficial policy of restricting where settlements could take place, the government was only allowing settlements in unpopulated areas of the West Bank with the idea that the populated areas could be given up for peace. So the young religious settlers started demanding to settle between the Palestinian cities of the West Bank and ran into a full-scale confrontation with the first government of Yitzhak Rabin.
Well, it was an expensive thing, wasn't it? Because guarding the settlements had to have put a real burden on the government.
that's something which has only become more apparent over the years. Part of the problem here was, again, this was a matter of the anachronism of settlement. In 1948, when Israel became independent, the outlying kibbutzim had been the frontline fortresses, and that had created in the Israeli popular imagination the idea of settlements as being a military asset. That's how you protected land. By 1967, this was completely obsolete. You could stop the army of 1948 with a kibbutz. You couldn't do that by 1967. In the 1973 Yom Kippur War, they had to evacuate the settlements on the front line. But it took a long time for it to soak into Israeli consciousness that these weren't a military burden.
Did the Yom Kippur War of 1973 change the whole thing?
The 1973 war convinced a much larger number of Israelis on one side of the spectrum that simply holding on to the territories wouldn't guarantee Israeli security, that settlements wouldn't guarantee Israeli security. It launched the first serious effort to negotiate with Arab states. By that time, the presence of the settlements already created a difficulty. But the process of negotiating with Egypt began with the 73 war, and the support for that negotiation began with the 73 war. The 73 war proved that simply having territory wouldn't guarantee Israel's safety.
But then in 1975, you say there was a turning point in the settlement movement. What happened then?
The religious settlers of the Gush Emunim movement that I described before, young religious Zionists who were convinced that settling the land was part of God's plan. They were very afraid that the Rabin government was going to give up part of the West Bank in negotiations with Jordan. They decided to stop that by settling near the West Bank city of Nablus. In the final all-out confrontation, thousands of young protesters flowed into the hills and camped out at the site. The government was afraid of the consequences of evacuating them and eventually caved in and let a small group stay there.
How are these people supporting themselves? Were they farming this land, or was this the equivalent of suburbs?
At that stage, exactly at that point, a transition was taking place, because the first settlements in occupied territory tended to be kibbutzim, farming communes, people who farmed the land. The religious settlers were much less interested in this, and one of the things that's fascinating about that confrontation in 1975 is that when the government agreed to let the small group stay there, the compromise was pounded out with the defense minister of the time, Shimon Peres. And Shimon Peres was at that time the greatest advocate of settlement in the Israeli government, and he threw a line into the compromise that his fellow ministers hadn't realized was going to be there that said that the army would provide jobs for the settlers.
Isn't it odd that Shimon Peres and Ariel Sharon, two of the strongest advocates for settlements, then changed?
History is ruled more than anything else by irony. And if you just stay around, you can always have a sense that, my gosh, how could this person do this thing?
Well, the whole thing, you say, was started by leftists. Were leftists still moving across the border, or had this already become an issue for the left to stop the settler movement?
By the late 70s, by the time that the right came to power and accelerated the settlement process, the left began step by step to separate itself from settlement, began pulling away from the idea. Certainly, there was also a generational change. As I said before, the younger people on the left weren't interested in it. And so by the late 70s, the 80s, it became clear that if you were pro-settlement in Israel, you were on the right. And if you were anti-settlement, you were on the left. That was true for the time. But what I found in my historical research is that we should not project the current situation back onto the origins. It was different then.
How many Israelis live in the West Bank now? And how does that compare to the Arab population?
There are about 250,000 Israelis living in the West Bank now. I've seen varying estimates of the Palestinian population. The last census was done a number of years ago, so I'm not going to try to give a proportion, but it's clearly a small minority. From one side, the settlers are a small minority. From another side, 250,000 people is a lot of people, and it's one of the major issues in Israeli politics today is that all the way over to the center-right, to Ehud Olmert, the front-runner in the Israeli elections, there's a recognition that Israel's going to have to give up at least some of those settlements. The problem is that people don't want to touch the big ones simply because of the social crisis involved in trying to evacuate so many people.
Well, we saw a major problem when the settlements in Gaza were closed down. I don't know whether it caused a housing crisis within Israel proper, but I'd imagine a quarter of a million people being moved back into the old boundaries of Israel would put a serious burden on the infrastructure.
The fact is, I don't really think that that's the major issue. I mean, in other words, in the 1990s, Israel absorbed 1 million immigrants from the former Soviet Union, and all it did was create an economic boom.
Many of them wound up in the West Bank, didn't they?
Not in such great numbers. But the real problem in terms of dismantling settlements is the confrontation between the settlers and the rest of the society. The sense that people have who live in the settlements, the government encouraged them to move there and is now telling them to leave, that the ideology itself is cracking. In the most hard line of the settlements, there is really an intensified sense of alienation, of fury at the government. And any government that wants to go ahead and dismantle these settlements, which, as I said, that's now the consensus that some will have to be taken down, is going to have to deal very delicately with how it does it to prevent violence.
My guest is Gershom, G-E-R-S-H-O-M, Gorenberg. His book, The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, from Times Books. Some people suspected that Ariel Sharon decided to pull out of the Gaza as a way of forestalling any a change in the settlement situation in the West Bank, that Gaza was a much less attractive and much more difficult place to administer.
There's an element of truth in that. Sharon did not intend to give up major portions of the West Bank. What exactly Sharon intended to do, we will not know now. There seems to be no likelihood that Sharon will ever return to political life. He's in a coma.
But he must have made some statements.
There were conflicting statements that came out of Sharon's inner circle. There were people who, close to him, who described the idea of the Gaza withdrawal. One of his top aides described it as a way of putting the diplomatic process in formaldehyde so that there wouldn't have to be any further pullouts. However, I think one thing that's important to note is that one of the key advocates close to Sharon for carrying out a further pullback was Ehud Olmert. So in that sense, Sharon's sudden stroke and departure from the political scene has put the power on the side of the Sharon group that was interested in pulling out further and dismantling more settlements.
But the whole situation has been complicated by Hamas's victory.
Yes.
If you can't negotiate anything with a group that says we're not going to negotiate with you.
Well, in the Israeli government and in the wider Israeli political debate, as the recognition has become stronger, has become more mainstream, that some settlements at least will have to be given up, there's been two approaches to it. One has been a negotiated settlement with the Palestinians, and one has been unilateral withdrawal. The advocates of unilateral withdrawal want to give up less. They know that to reach an agreement with the Palestinians, even the moderate Palestinians, the agreement would have to involve giving up much more land. Olmert was always an advocate of the unilateral approach and giving up less land. Sharon and Olmert and the others were distrustful of the Palestinians as a partner even before the Hamas election. The election of Hamas simply confirms what they were saying before, and it means that right now in the Israeli political spectrum, the unilateral approach is much stronger.
But even if the PLO had won the election, wouldn't Jerusalem have been the sticking point that would have prevented anything else from happening?
Jerusalem is clearly one of two or three central difficult issues to solve. The reason I say two or three is that within the Jerusalem issue, the most difficult problem is the problem of the holy places, of Temple Mount, otherwise known as Al-Aqsa. And then there's the issue of the Palestinian right of return. Those are the issues that are hardest to crack.
And then there's another one. There's the equivalent of a settlement movement in the old part of Jerusalem where an American millionaire, for example, has been buying up Palestinian properties and moving Jews in. It's the equivalent of building a settlement, isn't it?
Well, the goal is the same. I mean, those parts of Jerusalem are from an Israeli point of view, are under Israeli rule. They're annexed. But the reason that people move into, for instance, the Muslim quarter of the Old City is to prevent an Israeli pullback from those territories, from those neighborhoods.
So it seems to me there's really no ultimate solution. We're talking about places that have been settled now for 39 years, holy sites that everybody are holy to everybody. Is this an intractable situation?
My response is that I don't have the luxury of pessimism. If you live in the area, if you're confronted with the conflict, you can either throw your hands up in despair and then you leave yourself with a terrible situation, or you can look piece by piece, slowly, for the ways that agreement can be created, that new ways of looking at the situation can be found. I don't think that the situation is intractable. I don't think that we're ever going to reach a total peace where, it's like the American-Canadian border. But I think that it can be improved and that partial solutions can be found.
The Israeli novelist and political commentator David Grossman suggested some years ago that the solution should be simply to pull out of the territories, declare a peace, and assume that there'll be some years of turmoil, unfortunately, people who'll try to undermine the peace. But in time, the situation would be seen as advantageous to both sides, and a peace would be established.
I think that
Forgive me, David Grossman, if I have simplified your position.
I would say that from Israel's point of view, a negotiated agreement with the Palestinians is preferable. The reason that there's much more talk of unilateral approaches today is because the prospect of negotiating with the Hamas is so daunting, seems so difficult. And one of the consequences of that is that if there is a unilateral pullout, it probably won't be from the entire West Bank. And that will mean that some elements of the conflict will continue. I think that there's a feeling within Israel today that that would still reduce some of the friction and improve our situation.
It's assumed that Olmert is going to win this election with the new Kadima Party. What does that mean? What have they been saying about the settlements? And what do polls indicate about how Israeli voters feel about pulling out of the West Bank?
Olmert has been talking about another unilateral withdrawal like the one in Gaza from parts of the West Bank. He's made very general descriptions of what he'd like to give up and what he'd like to hold on to. He still is talking about holding on to a significant part of the West Bank, but the suggestions, the outline of what he said means that many settlements, including some of the most important ones, would be evacuated. His opposition from the right has been declaring that this election is a referendum on the idea of unilateral withdrawal. In that respect, at least, I think that they're right. And if the polls are correct, it means that a strong majority of the Israeli public is getting ready to vote for parties that are saying that part of the West Bank must be given up.
Because Labor is number two, and Likud right now is number three in projections.
Right. And even the Likud makes sort of uncertain, ambivalent statements about what it might give up.
Netanyahu says he's going to give up something?
Right. And that's very significant, because what it means is, whereas 30 years ago, for an Israeli political party to be part of the mainstream, it had to tell you that it was willing to settle at least somewhere in the occupied territories. Today, for an Israeli political party to be mainstream, it has to tell you that it's willing to give up at least a little bit.
Israel is still a small country, which means, I assume, that people who would be for complete withdrawal from the occupied territories would have relatives or friends who live in these settlements. Does that complicate things a bit?
There is a sense in Israel that the whole place is a village. If you work in a profession, you know everybody else who works in that profession. Families are interlocked. You could say, well, the really hardline settlers are Orthodox and many of their opponents are not Orthodox, except that families are mixed up on that thing as well. I constantly hear discussions. For instance, my cousin, who's a settler, invited us to his son's bar mitzvah, but we don't want to go because it's in a settlement. Yes, the politics are always personal.
Uh-huh. Has that affected your life as well? Do you have relatives who are settlers?
I don't personally, because I came to Israel by myself and from the United States, and my family is in the United States. But I've had those kind of issues come up in my social circle, certainly.
Did any of the Gaza settlers wind up moving over to the West Bank?
There are some of them I know who are in the Golan.
And the Golan will be hard to give up as well now, because it is a major source of Israeli revenue, isn't it?
Well, the Golan is most difficult to give up because, first of all, from the Israeli point of view, Israel annexed it. So just on a political level, it would be harder to give up. And because there doesn't seem to be any political process with the Syrians.
Gershom Gorenberg's book, The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of the Settlements, 1967 to 1977, is published by Times Books. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, a look at the notoriously violent Aryan Brotherhood prison gang on this week's Underreported, plus Erica Jong on writing and sexuality, and best-selling journalist Sebastian Younger, who's just returned from Afghanistan, plus Zlata Filipovic shares the diary she wrote in Sarajevo during the Bosnian conflict. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neeshick. We had help today from Brian Levinson, Isha Sabatini-Sloan, Melody Lee, and Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.